As already announced, the topic of today's short talk is soul farming, agriculture, soul farming. Everything on this earth, every processes of nature and all the activities of mankind, everything that is observable in this world follows a heavenly pattern. Nothing happens here by accident. It all happens based on certain heavenly pattern. Sunrise and sunset, sleeping and waking, war, crime, diseases, riots and revolutions. Similarly, human activities such as reaping and sowing, harvest, all these have their cosmic pattern. On the cosmic pattern, everything in the earth is built, works upon, and revolves around. Saint Paul says in one of his writings that this world is an enigmatical mirror of pure truth. This world is an enigmatical mirror of pure truth. So, great poets with their inner eye have this vision. It is said that Kumaravyasa, Kannada poet, had this uncanny ability to take the most mundane, worldly, even what we would call as vulgar activities on the earth and elevate it to something high, spiritual and divine. He had the power to transmute even the most worldly thing into a heavenly pattern and connect it with his heart and soul, which was on Krishna, Lord Krishna. So he says in the beginning of Kumaravyasa Bharata, Tiliya Heduve Krishna Kateyanu, means all the actors in the Mahabharata are one or the other aspects of Krishna himself. So I will tell only the story of Krishna and Duryodhana, Arjuna, Yudhishthira. All of them are aspects of Krishna. And Wordsworth. Yesterday we had a beautiful lecture in the Indian Institute of World Culture about the romantic period, American romanticism, and the poets who were shining and who gave that vision of nature, the transcendental vision of nature. Emerson, Thoreau, William Wordsworth. There, the speaker was mentioning about Wordsworth and his poem, which we all studied in our first PUC, Daffodil, right? Quite famous poem, where he says, the poet was able to see something which is quite common, which is a bunch of daffodils while he was walking on the street and connected to something cosmic. So poets have that vision. And it is on this kind of vision, this basis of heavenly pattern reflected in all earthly activity, that we find great sages like Vyasa, who are able to see a fight between two families or two parts of the same family, brothers, two branches of the same family, and convey the deepest philosophical, metaphysical truths about nature through this kind of conflict, which we read as Mahabharata. Right? Similarly, Srinivasa Kalyana, Girija Kalyana, and all the Puranas have a deeper meaning, deeper symbolical meaning that we can gather. This is not something unique to only India. Sages have been there, present in all parts of the world for the elevation of humanity, and all their teachings is one and the same. Their purpose, goal and aim is one and the same. And their endeavor is the same, which is soul farming. Soul farming. And in order to elevate the man's mind, which left to itself would stoop down and engage only with earthly things, they introduce these epics, these poems, these traditions, and set up rules and traditions and customs, which most of us blind masses generally just follow them. But one who tries to seek the meaning into it will find that there is a great purpose behind that. So it is all designed in such a way that the mind of the man is led into something higher and nobler. Because Madame Blavatsky says, man is despondent and despairs in this world because for the sole reason that his eyes are riveted upon only mundane things, on only earthly things, on only temporary things, things belonging to this body and this earth. And she says further that if a man were to recognize the inner, invisible, immortal essence in him and the great purpose for which he is here, then his life will be joyful, optimistic. Even in the midst of all the sorrows and troubles, there will be great optimism. So festivals, epics, customs, they were all set up with this hidden agenda, you know, hidden agenda. So coming to Makara Sankranti, the harvest festival, very famous in India because India is predominantly an agricultural country, which said we are blessed with such fertile soil and a weather which is so conducive, plenty of sunshine and plenty of water, and the traditional wisdom of agriculture going back to millennium. And for one who has a higher vision for life, vision in life, agriculture is the best profession. Agriculture is the best. He's close to nature. He gets exercise for his body to keep it good. And he has sufficient time to contemplate, think, and learn from nature. So agriculture is a very good profession. Unfortunate that in our country we have reached this kind of condition where the kind of farmer suicides that we see, alarming number, and pollution of water, and decimation of traditional knowledge and all. Anyway, that takes us into a different topic. Let's not go there. If you look at the Chinese system, they also have harvest festival. Their harvest festival coincides with our Sharad Purnima, which is about September, October time, right? They, in the autumnal full moon, they celebrate their harvest festival. And beautiful legends, beautiful stories and mythology is mixed with their festivals. Some of them I'll just recollect. The autumnal full moon that comes, Sharad Purnima, in the month of Ashwini, they celebrate it as giving respect and commemorating a certain dragon which brought them rain. The dragon which brought the rain is commemorated. And then they link rejuvenation with moon and water. Rejuvenation, revival, resuscitation is linked with moon and water. The dragon which brought the rains. The dragon which brought the rains. And the local legends there say, sun is the father, moon is the mother. And all the stars in the heaven are their children. And whenever there is a full moon, then moon is pregnant, because she is round. And then it becomes a crescent moon, she has delivered a baby. And then there is also another famous legend of Huan Yi, a great archer, a great hero of the Chinese, in the Chinese region. And it so happened that one day, 10 sons SONS, suns, arose in the heavens. And they scorched and burned all the harvest, everything on the earth. So this great archer took upon the task to shoot down the suns. So he shot down all the 9 suns and left one so that it is sufficient enough for sunlight, warmth, and radiance on the earth. That's why we have only 1 sun and not 10. And for this great benefit that he conferred upon mankind, he was rewarded by one of the immortals in the sky with a bottle of elixir of life, Amrita. He was given an elixir of life. And he loved his wife so much that he did not take the elixir. Because if he takes the elixir, then he becomes immortal, whereas she dies and goes away. But he wanted to die and go along with her. So he does not take the elixir, but safely keeps it in his house. His student gets to know that his master has been rewarded with such a great treasure. So when this hero has gone deep into the jungle, he goes to his master's house, tries to force his wife, Cheng Yi, to give that bottle of elixir. And Cheng Yi knows that the student has evil intentions. He wants to become immortal and rule over all men and become a tyrant. So she reluctantly drinks the elixir and saves the humanity by drinking the elixir. And by the time the hero comes from the forest, he sees that his beloved is rising up and reaching the full moon to become one with the autumnal full moon, Sharad Purnima. And therefore, to commemorate that hero and his wife, who is now still the full moon, the Chinese, traditional Chinese, probably even today in the rural areas, celebrate it by offering cakes and fruits to the autumnal full moon. You know, the other day we were studying fish, sin, and soma, and how it is related to the immortal part of man. In the secret doctrine, the other day we were studying. So if you remember that, it makes a lot of sense. Even in Indian tradition, we have Buddha, who is born from soma, wisdom born from moon, soma, connected with the immortal aspect of it. So all these beautiful legends, you know, once you start reading them, you get, it's called the Golden Week, is it? In Chinese. 1 week of celebration. Golden Week. It seems it's called as the Golden Week in China, and everyone in the country celebrates it. So like this, there are beautiful legends connected with the harvest season. And moon, harvest, sun, all these come into these legends and these mythologies and these allegories in various ways. And one who knows how to decipher these symbols will gain immense knowledge from these stories. That's why the Sufi sage Ibn Arabi, he says that whenever a prophet comes, he speaks in dual language. He speaks in dual language. One for the masses, but in the same words that he speaks for the masses, there is a hidden meaning in it. Same as what Jesus says, I speak to them in parables because they understand it not, but you understand it, therefore I give you wisdom. See what Ibn Arabi says. The prophets use a concrete language because they address themselves to the collectivity. And they trust in the comprehension of the wise one who will hear them. All that the prophets brought of sciences is clothed in forms which are accessible to the most ordinary intellectual capacity. So that he who does not go to the heart of the things stops at this clothing and takes it for what is the most beautiful, whereas the man of subtle comprehension the diver who fishes the pearls of wisdom knows how to indicate for what reason such and such a divine truth is clothed in terrestrial form. He evaluates the robe and the material which it is made of and knows by that all that it covers, attaining thus to a science which remains inaccessible to those who do not have the knowledge of this all. Clearly, he is speaking of the twofold meaning in all the scriptures. This is Ibn Arabi, Sufi sage. Sufi sage. And elsewhere, he or some other Sufi sage says that when Prophet spoke, he spoke in this dual tongue, one for the khas, khas, the Arabic word, or even in Hindi, khas means the chosen, the elect, the select, one for the khas and one for the multitude. So like that, Sharad is Makar Sankranti for us, and the season of harvest also has a profound meaning. If we take farming itself, there are seven distinct things associated with farming. And seven is such a sapta. Seven is what a great number it is. What a mysterious, occult number. It occurs everywhere in the universe and in man. In all aspects of universe, in all the inner and outer aspects of man, seven is formed. You know, we can go on and on for the next 77 years from now and talk everything about seven and still not finish what seven entirely means or represents. What are these seven? Look at this. When you say agriculture or farming, there is the soil or the land. There is the landlord. There is the laborer. And then there is the grain, whatever is grown, the seed which ultimately gives the grain. And then there is the chaff, separation of the grain from the chaff. And then there is water and the sun. These are the seven distinct elements that water and the sun. Without these, you can't have farming. Without sun or without water or without land, without grain, without chaff being produced, or without a lord of the land or the laborer, you can't have farming at all. Seven distinct things. What each of these seven distinct things mean when this key of farming is applied to psycho-spiritual soul evolution. Few points about this is what we will plan to. When it is applied to cosmogony, it means something else. When it is applied to anthropogenesis, it may mean something else. But in relation to ourselves, what is the lesson that we can gather for our daily life? That we will try to cover a few points in the next 10-15 minutes or so, and then take up any questions. The first most common sense and very straightforward lesson that we can gather from farming, agriculture, is the relationship between cause and effect. If I sow a pepper seed, is assured that I will only find pepper plant grown. If I sow ragi, only ragi crop will grow. Never in nature will you find a disconnection between cause and effect. Right? This has a very important bearing upon our life and our perspective of our. It is this, all that we are facing in our life, circumstances of life, the good and evil that we face, the health of the body, the health of the mind, faculties of the mind, how long will this body last, what family am I born in, what opportunities do I have in life, as well as lack of opportunity, every single thing is the fruit or the crop or the harvest that we are enjoying today. both good and evil. Both are the harvest that we are enjoying in the field of our body, mind, and the world. We as souls are enjoying this, good and evil, experiencing good and evil. So this harvest, where did this harvest come about? Have we ever seen a plant grow without a seed? Impossible. Unthinkable. And have we ever sown, like, have we ever seen, like already said, one kind of seed given rise to some other kind of plant? No. Similarly, our circumstances of life and all the other things that were mentioned before are the exact result, outcome of the actions, thoughts, and emotions and words that we have generated in the past. The farmer, when he harvests, a good farmer will have sufficient amount of good grain and little bit of wheat. If the farmer is negligent, the laborer is negligent, then the field is overtaken by weeds, and the weeds will take up all the nutrition and leave little nutrition to the crop, and the crop grows less. At the end of the harvest season, like we celebrate Makar Sankranti, when he has to take the harvest to his master, the landlord, he will have little grain and lot of wheat, little useful thing and lot of useless. Right? So the first idea that comes to mind is that we are responsible for our life. Our thoughts today, especially our thoughts, feelings, and emotions, not only merely the action, especially our thoughts. As they say, kaya, vacha, manasa, manas, most important. That's where we are primarily experiencing our past seeds, which have grown into crop, as well as sowing new seeds. So what kind of seeds are we sowing today? As Buddha says, are we sowing seeds for trees which will bear evil fruit or bitter fruit, which we will be forced to pluck and eat? Or are we sowing seeds of compassion, charity, forgiveness, and goodwill for others, which will bear sweet fruit, which we will enjoy in happiness and contentment in the future? So what are we sowing? So this cause and effect comes out very beautifully in the harvest festival when we try to discern. And once we understand that every single thing that is happening in our life, we are the primary responsible agent, then our attitude of complaint goes. And with the attitude of complaint going, our actual suffering and sorrow also reduces. See, we feel sad, sorrow, or agitated when something bad happens to us, because innately we have the feeling that I did not deserve this. It came from an external agency, whether it is a person or a circumstance or some God or something that we may postulate. It came from him or them, and therefore I don't deserve it. What wrong did I do to deserve such and such a thing? I don't deserve it. As long as the feeling is there, the suffering exponentially increases. That's why Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman Rajarishi, he said, remove from your mind the thought that I have been unjustly attacked, or there's some injustice done to me. And with the removal of that mere thought, and by accepting responsibility for our present conditions of life, you have removed more than half of your suffering. Because suffering is primarily mental, more than actual circumstances. It's our attitude which makes us suffer more. So by changing the attitude, you get a lot of relief. Relief. So the great teachers, whenever they come, they first focus on this idea that You are responsible. And they are not telling this merely from an emotional point of view to help you from going out of mental suffering, reducing your mental suffering. That's not their mere intention. They are speaking of this basic fact of life of the relationship between cause and effect. If the effect is of a certain kind, or the fruit is of a certain kind that I'm eating in life, then the causes must be of the same kind. Point number one. Point number two, if I sow a seed in my plot here, can I expect the plant to grow in my neighbor's plot? No, wherever the seed is sown, there only the crop will arrive. Right? Similarly, if somebody has sown a seed in his field, I cannot expect the tree to grow here in my plot, which means all the experiences that we are having in our life is a direct outcome of our own actions. If we are finding poisonous weeds in our plot here, it means that I have let it to grow. I have some or the other time, knowingly or unknowingly, cast the seed in the soil which is growing now. So accept responsibility, cut that poisonous seed, grow something better. That idea of cause and effect, the law of karma, as it is said in the Hindu and the Buddhist system, is most important. In fact, one of the Upanishads speak of, what do they translate in English? The immutable law, unchanging law, aksharasya prashasana, which is that there is a moral order which is ruling the universe with justice, a moral order which maintains harmony. The consequence of that understanding is that everything that is happening in my life is right, is exactly correct, is exactly deserved, and in some sense desired by me. Even the evil things that is happening to me is desired by me by sometime in the past in ignorance. I thought that will bring me good, but it has brought me evil. But I desired for it. It is deserved and it is desired. So this idea comes out very clearly. And you take Gospel according to Saint Matthew, chapter 7, verse 2, speaks of with what measures you meet, the same will be measured unto you. And so many incidents in Mahabharata, Ramayana, elsewhere, about how this doctrine of karma, doctrine of responsibility, doctrine of moral law is brought out again and again, like in the incident of conversation between Shukracharya and his daughter Devayani, where Devayani accuses Sharmishtha of causing her hurt. But Shukracharya says that who will cause you hurt or who will cause you good? Your own past actions which have put you in this position. Accept responsibility. So that idea is quite strong in the idea of sowing and reaping. What we have sown, we are reaping. The other idea that comes is that of the landlord and the laborer. Beautiful similes, metaphors are used. Take the Upanishad, one of the Upanishads, where it speaks of a tree. And in the tree, there are the lower branches and then there is a higher branch. And in the lower branches, there are various fruits, some of bitter, some of sweet. And then there is one bird in the lower branch which keeps hopping from branch to branch and keeps eating bitter and sweet fruits. But in the same tree, in the higher branch, there is a bird which is a watcher, which is a witness. It does not eat anything, it does not do anything, but it watches what this other bird is doing. It's a beautiful way of bringing to our mind the dual aspects of man. In us, there are two distinct aspects. the one aspect which is acting, which is experiencing, which is doing things. And this lower aspect, if you may call so, is the one which is involved in life. And we think we are that. Whereas Upanishads and also all other teachers say that you are actually the witness. You are on the higher branch. You are watching this world which is going from fruit to fruit and experiencing, but you are identifying yourself with this other world and therefore you are caught. And this identification is called as ahamkara. Ahamkara. Aham, I am that. Ahamkara. I am that. I am that. Self-identifying attachment. Take your own experience. We are all of various ages, right? From the birth of, from the time we can recollect, from young kids to this present moment, how many things have changed in ourselves? Our body, unrecognizable. Our mind, our ideas, our priorities in life. Every single thing has undergone transformation. How many experiences have we had? Every day, some or the other new thing, some problem, some good. We have gone through all those experiences. But is there not something in us which is unchanging? Is there not something in us which we call as myself? Not the name. We all have names. Not the name. Not even the form, because the form is constantly changing. But there is a sense of self-identity. The feeling that I am myself and not somebody else. All these things have changed. Ideas, feelings, emotions, priorities, the body, circumstances. Everything has changed over the years. But the feeling and the sense of identity, I am I and nobody else, that is not true. The very root and essence of that identity is eternal, is immortal, is divine. So these two aspects, in relation to our farming analogy, makes a lot of sense. It is said that when we take up a body, we are soul. When we take up body, when we take birth in the womb of the mother, we make connection with the body. Our entire nature, our entire being cannot incarnate. Cannot take complete control of the body, because this body, which is the field of action, this body, which is the instrument, which is the exact outcome, the result of all past deeds, this is still not entirely pure. We have not purified our mind, heart, and the senses such that our divine essence can completely incarnate. So, from our real essence, a laborer is sent. We are the landlord. We send a laborer into this field. This is our agricultural field. Our body, mind, and the senses is the field. A laborer is sent. A ray proceeds from us. Like a ray proceeds from the sun. A ray proceeds from our essential nature. And that gets caught up in the gunas, as Krishna says in the Gita. That gets caught up in the guna. That's what we call as the lower mind. So there is a higher divine aspect of us, and then the lower involved or terrestrial aspect of us. And there is a constant conflict between these. Essential nature is divine. The voice of conscience is there in all of us. Voice of conscience is one, heaven aspiring. And then the conflict comes because we have that ray aspect, which is situated in darkness, which is situated in the body, which is situated among desires. And that is downward tending towards the earth, about the body and its senses and its comfort. So there is this constant conflict between the two for control of this body and the mind. Right? So this conflict is Mahabharata. Both Pandavas and Kauravas come from the same branch, they're brothers. But one is evil tendencies, another one listens to Krishna, which is the sun within us, Atman, spirit. So, and why is the laborer sent into the field? His job is to garner experiences, garner spiritual food. Every feeling of ours, which is noble, everything unselfish, every good thing that we wish for others, every endeavor of ours, which transcends oneself, which has the good of others in purview, that is spiritual food. That is the true harvest. All other things that we accumulate for oneself, for one's own good, security, happiness, and, patterning of our personality, is all weeds, which become so much of a burden in the next season. In the next season or in the next birth, the laborer would have got only a little bit of seed and a lot of wheat, and it's a headache for the landlord. So we have taken up this life, we have taken a body in this life for a great divine purpose. And the deity, the God, the divinity is there deep within us, looking at us. In fact, we are that. We identify ourselves with the body and the senses. Which is why the Egyptians, they said when a person dies and goes, they have detailed explanation of what happens after death. Very symbolic again. Very symbolic. They say in one of the stages that after death, that the person, he is put into a field of anru, or we call it the field of farming, the field of harvest. There he has to labor and he has to glean wheat. He has to glean the wheat. Some of them glean the wheat which is only 3 cubits high. Some of them glean wheat which is 5 cubits high. Some of them glean wheat which is 7 cubits high. Those who glean wheat of 5 and 7 cubits, they experience deep happiness and heaven. Those who do only 3 cubits of gleaning of wheat, they don't experience heaven. So much meaning is there in this when we understand how man is actually sevenfold. And the 3, 5, and 7 refers to the 3rd, 5th, and 7th principles. And that makes a lot of sense. If we have time, we will go into that. Otherwise, we will skip it. And this same idea comes in Bible also, right? Gospel according to St. Matthew. I am the true vine. You are the branches. I am the true vine, V-I-N-E, vine. You are the branches. If you abide in me, then there is hope for you. But if you don't abide in me, this is all Jesus telling you, Christ speaking. If you don't abide in me, then my father, the husbandman, will break you and then put you into the fire, cast you into the fire to be burned. Same idea of the laborer and the landlord, mentioned in a different, more allegorical, more poetic way. It is this, the personality is the branch. Our spiritual nature is a vine, V-I-N-E. The whole purpose of this personality coming into life is to sow good seeds and destroy the weeds and therefore bear fruit, which is the grapes. It is from the grapes that the vine is made, W-I-N-E, vine is made. That vine is spiritual wisdom. That's why the Sufis say, that I am always intoxicated. We should not take it as daru, drinking alcohol. It's not that alcohol. It's the spiritual wisdom which the Sufi is deeply intoxicated with. he is intoxicated with the idea of that there is only one self, one spirit, one life, which is masquerading under all these forms. So he identifies himself with every being. That is the intoxication that he is speaking. Even Shishunal Sharif, which is a Kannada poet, he says, Gudgudiya Sedi Nodi. Gudgudi is hookah. You have this hookah and see what kind of intoxication you will get. So that this is the thing. This is the thing about true wine and the branches and the wine that is formed out of the branches. Therefore, there is communal drinking of wine in the church. Communal drinking. No, there is actual wine which is consumed. That's not what it is. This spiritual wisdom. Spiritual wisdom. And even the allegory says that the King Messiah washed his garments in wine. Washing the garments in wine, W-I-N-E, is this. His whole personality was saturated with spiritual wisdom, spiritual knowledge. That is, he has led such a life wherein, as Krishna says, from every pore of his body, light was shining. So our purpose here is to do this kind of soul farming. What we do is to put more and more boulders in our field, put more and more poisonous seeds, thinking that after death everything will be over. No, sir, it's not over, because you will be sent again to the same field and you will have the fruits which are grown and the crop which will be there. You have to glean it and eat it and experience it. And learn from it. So with that in mind, we will close. There is one beautiful poem. If there are no points, we will consider it. This is by Allama Prabhu, great Vachanakara. He speaks of the same soul farming in a more graphic manner. Consider that if you don't have any.